Okay, let's go ahead and turn in our Bibles to Isaiah chapter 10. Isaiah chapter 10. Isaiah chapter 7 through 12 are referred to by many people as the book of Emmanuel because the theme, God is with us, is scattered throughout the chapters. No matter how ungodly Judah had become, no matter what judgment she had merited by God, God had made a promise that through Abraham's seed, all nations of the earth would be blessed. And he also promised that through David's seed, he would establish his throne, the throne of his kingdom forever. And so despite allowing the Assyrian flood to get up to Judah's neck, they would be ultimately protected, as you see in chapters 7 through 8, because God is with us. That's the theme of those two chapters. Then in chapter 9, we saw God's plan to liberate them from the darkness that they had plunged themselves into by bringing them a great light, the child Emmanuel, who would usher in a kingdom and government that would endure forever, established by justice and righteousness. Even the scattered northern kingdom of Israel would experience this, but before they could experience it, God was going to have to purge them of the filth, as we saw in chapter 9, God's hand outstretched against them. And so as we get into chapter 10, the focus is now going to shift more toward Assyria, and not only God's purpose in using them as his instrument of judgment, but also his long-term plans for them. But before we get into the chapters, I want to give you just a little bit of history about the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrians had been a minor power in the Mideast since about the 12th century BC when it was founded by the original Tiglath-Pileser. But they had waxed and waned in power for several hundred years, only getting involved with God's people on a handful of occasions. We know from Assyrian annals that King Ahab of the northern kingdom of Israel joined a coalition with other nations to fight against Assyria. That's what's called the Battle of Karkar, led by Assyrians King Shalmaneser III. Assyria won. This picture on the right is probably the most famous of Assyrian artifacts. Does anybody know what that's called? It's the Black Obelisk. It's housed in the British Museum. It shows five reliefs of kings bowing down to Shalmaneser III and offering tribute. The most famous of its reliefs is King Jehu bowing down before Shalmaneser III. The relief reads in Akkadian, "The tribute of Jehu, son of Omri, I received from him silver, gold, a golden bowl, a golden vase with pointed bottom, golden tumblers, golden buckets, 10, a staff for a king, and spears." Now, this was a very significant archaeological find in the 19th century because it displays the earliest ancient depiction of a biblical figure. But not long after Jehu, as we've already talked about a little bit, God begins to allow the northern kingdom of Israel to gain a little bit more momentum to expand its territory, reaching its peak during Jehu's great-grandson's reign, Jeroboam II. And at the same time, Assyria was waning in power and really struggling to find its grip as a nation. And God takes advantage of Assyria's decline by sending the prophet Jonah to preach to them, and he wanted no part of that. But as we know from the book of Jonah, Nineveh repented, and they begin to regain a lot of that power that they had had before and would inevitably become extremely dominant during the times of Isaiah under its new king, Tiglath-Pileser III. And as we've already looked at, Tiglath-Pileser III, he sacks Syria, he sacks the northern kingdom of Israel, leaving nothing but Samaria, and is severely afflicting Judah also, which we saw in chapter 8. They were just up to their neck in Assyria. Now, as we read in chapter 9, verse 8, through chapter 10, verse 4 that we studied last week, Assyria would finish the job of taking down the entire northern kingdom of Israel. How did this happen? The details are in 2 Kings chapter 17 here. When Tiglath-Pileser III took out the northern part of the northern kingdom of Israel, all that practically remained was its capital city, Samaria. An Israelite named Hoshea killed Israel's king Pekah, and Tiglath-Pileser III installed Hoshea as king under the condition that he continue to pay tribute. But this pretty much ended the Syro-Ephraimite War. But 4 to 5 years into Hosea's reign, Tiglath-Pileser III died in 727 BC. His son reigned in his place, and he took the name of Shalmaneser V, depicted in that relief there in the upper right. Now, typically when an Assyrian king died, this caused all the nations that had previously subjugated to them to rebel. And we read in 2 Kings 17, in the first 6 verses, that Hosea at first paid tribute to Shalmaneser V, but then he stopped. And Shalmaneser V uncovered the fact that Hosea had actually been secretly corresponding with Egypt. And so Shalmaneser V has Hosea thrown in prison. They begin a siege of Samaria that you can see there in verse 5, lasted 3 whole years. But Shalmaneser V died before he could complete the siege. Now, the details are sketchy of how he died, but Shalmaneser indicates that he deported, the Assyrian reliefs indicate that shortly before Samaria actually fell, that Sargon II would take Shalmaneser's place. And that's in this relief here on the lower right. That's Sargon II there. Some think that that's actually Shalmaneser V that he's talking to, but we do know from the Akkadian text that that's Sargon II there. Sargon II would be the one to actually sack the city of Samaria in the northern kingdom of Israel, completing it, deporting its inhabitants. And when he does that in 722 BC, there's nothing left of the northern kingdom of Israel anymore. Now, in the Assyrian annals, Shalmaneser indicates that he deported 27,290 people from Samaria, but this number only includes the inhabitants of the actual city. Some have suggested that number could actually be extrapolated to about 200,000. When you consider the people that were deported from the countryside surrounding the actual walled cities. But Sargon II then rebuilt Samaria, and then he filled it with people from other areas. And you can kind of see there in that text, it's a little hard to read because some of the Akkadian text is hard to make out. And so sometimes when you see these in brackets, that's what they think it is probably saying. But he brought in foreigners to settle in there, and then he took the people that were in Samaria and the land around it, and he brought them back into the Assyrian lands in the northeast. So that's how the end of the northern kingdom actually happened, and I meant to go over this at the end of the last class, but we just ran out of time. Okay, all that's to say, here's a question for you as we begin the class tonight. Why would God allow a pagan nation like Assyria who's so cruel, as you can see from all these reliefs, all the things that they would do to their captors? We know that they beheaded captors, they flayed their skin alive, they would hang them and torture them. I mean, these are all things that we find in the old Assyrian libraries that they've uncovered in Iraq. Why would he allow a people this awful and this cruel to defeat God's people? Isaiah gives the reason in chapter 10, verse 5 and 6. He says, "Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hands is my indignation. I send it against a godless nation and commission it against the people of my fury to capture booty and to seize plunder and to trample them down like mud in the streets." Okay, so in chapters 9 and at the beginning of chapter 10, we saw that phrase repeated 4 times, right? In spite of all this, his anger is not turned away and his hand is still stretched out. What specifically was in God's hand to punish the nation of Israel and Judah? What was in his hand?
Assyria.
Exactly. Yeah, I was thinking metaphorically, the rod of my anger, okay? So that's what was in his hand, a rod called Assyria. Now, the rod and staff were used by shepherds to correct and to direct their sheep, respectively, and that is exactly what God is using Assyria to do to his people. Assyria was simply God's instrument of judgment. That's what they were. And notice the irony in verse 6 there, that God is sending Assyria against a godless nation. Who's he talking about there? Who's the godless nation? Israel. Yeah, his own people. You see the irony there? Now, anyone living in Israel, Judah, would look at Assyria and think, man, I know we're not doing right, but surely we're more godlier than the Assyrian Empire. But keep in mind that Judah and Israel, they had God's law. And they rejected the light, and that made their fall that much worse. And with all the advantages that we Christians have living in the United States, we need to heed this as well. That phrase, to capture booty and to seize plunder, is almost identical to that phrase we saw at the beginning of chapter 8, Maher Shalel Hashbaz, indicating the ongoing fulfillment of God's word that would dwell in the flesh of Isaiah's son. And so this was God's purpose for raising up Assyria, judgment against his people. And yet, look at that first word there in verse 5. What does that first word, woe, imply about what God's going to inevitably do to Assyria? Yeah, he's saying, you Assyria, you're as good as dead, right? But wait a minute, he's using them, right? But you're as good as dead. All right? So think about this. Where does judgment begin, according to Peter? It begins in the what? In the household of God, okay? And that's why the focus thus far has been on Judah and it's been on Israel. But after God gets done using Assyria, they too will be judged. Now, if I'm Assyria, I'm thinking, well, that's not fair. I mean, you're the one that raised us up. So, I mean, we're doing as we're told. So why are you getting all down on us, right? Well, that's a good question. Why is God getting all down on Assyria? Well, the issue wasn't purpose. They had the same purpose. The issue was motive. Verse 7, yet it does not so intend, nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather it is its purpose to destroy and to cut off many nations. In other words, though God and Assyria shared the same purpose, that purpose was conquest, their motives for doing so were entirely different. Despite the work that Jonah had done among them, Assyria wasn't seeking God's glory, were they? They were seeking their own rise to power. Their goal was selfish ambition and to bring destruction to everybody that they met. That arrogant heart that he's mentioning there in verse 7 is the same word used to describe Israel's arrogance in chapter 9, verse 9. Now, what are the grounds of their confidence? Look in verse 8. For it says, are not my princes all kings? Is not Calno like Carchemish, or Hamath like Arpad, or Samaria like Damascus? You can almost understand their confidence because their military leaders had conquered kings. And so why shouldn't their military leaders think of themselves as kings? By the way, anytime you see a list of cities, you're going to be thinking, boy, I wish I'd have paid attention in that Bible geography class back in the old day. But anytime you see these cities, always look for a pattern. They're always listed multiply like that because he's trying to get us to look at the pattern, okay? These are three pairs of six cities, and the first city in each pair, the first of each pair is further south than the second one there. And so really what the idea is for listing all these cities is Assyria is saying, I took this city, I can take down this one as well. I mean, to Assyria, no city was more unique than the other. They were just cities to be checked off a list. And in Hebrew poetry, when you see lists of cities like this, always look for the patterns, always look for the repetitions. All right, look in verse 10. As my hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria. Now, wait a minute. As my hand? My hand? No. Whose hand had done all this? It was God's hand, not Assyria's hand. It was God's hand. But pagan monarchs of the day always connected their victories and their defeats to the strengths and the weaknesses of the nation's God. So his boast that the idols of the nation were greater than Judah's was due to the fact that idol construction was usually more exquisite looking than what God had set up in and around the temple. God's altar was very basic looking compared to some of those pagan altars. You remember that even Ahaz thought that the idol in Damascus was greater than what was at the temple, which is why he had one built and set there in the temple grounds. So Assyria's problem in verse 10 is they are seeing the future in light of the past. They're saying, oh, I've done all this stuff in the past. Surely I can do all this in the future. This is why it's important that anytime we start to make plans, what does James tell us we need to be thinking about? If the Lord wills. Thank you, Troy. That's exactly right. James chapter 4, 13 through 16. All right.
And then, that verse right there sounds very similar to what Nebuchadnezzar said.
Yeah.
When he was standing overlooking his kingdom, he said, is this not great Babylon that I have built?
Yeah.
And they're saying, by my hand, I did this. and never gave credit to God.
Yep, Babylon copied a lot of things from Assyria, including that arrogant heart. That's absolutely right, yeah. Look in verse 11. So again, verse 10, as my hand has reached to the kingdoms and of the idols whose graven images are greater than those of Jerusalem and Syria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her images just as I have done to Samaria and her idols? And so clearly Assyria did not see Jehovah as any different than the other gods. And that is blasphemy. It characterizes God as just another pagan idol that couldn't stop Assyria. And this would turn out to be Assyria's biggest mistake. And this keys in on what the real issue is that we're going to see beginning in verse 12. And that's arrogance, what Troy was alluding to earlier. Yeah, I was going to take some comments. Now go ahead, Hans.
Could this also be a reference to the fact that that Jerusalem is kind of indistinguishable from its past and how corrupt it's become in its idolatry?
Possibly, could
they be referencing that too?
That it's possible. I think one of the reasons why I don't typically think so is because they usually would take idols from other nations and make copies and worship them on their high places there. And so they were definitely more available. But I think even the pagan nations like Assyria knew that the center of their worship was supposed to surround what was going on in the temple in Jerusalem. But that's really speculation on my part. I mean, again, that's one of those like, you know, which is right. We don't really know. That's probably my best guess, Hans. But that's a good point that you bring up, though. Certainly, they were not monotheistic always in their history or in their thinking, though that's always what God intended for them. So, all right, any other thoughts on this before we get into it? Yeah, Larry?
I'm trying to get it clear in my head. So, shall I not do Jerusalem and her images? Is that what you're saying, is they saw Jehovah as just another idol?
Yeah, I believe so. And when you go to Isaiah chapter 36 and 37, and you look at the Rabshakeh speech, he speaks in that same kind of language that we're seeing right there. They had no idea that worship to Jehovah was really different than what they did as pagans. They just assumed what Jerusalem was doing was just worshiping their own unique God of their nations. Yeah, okay. That was a big mistake. Yes, sir.
What was the year where J.Q. was offering the tribute that you discussed?
That would have been, I think, at the beginning of the 800s BC, give or take a decade or so.
And they were completely wiped out, 722, 722.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they paid tribute for 60 years?
Off and on. Some of them stopped, some of them started, and that generally would determine whether Tiglath-Pileser or any other king was going to come knocking on your door. Yeah. Yeah. Any other comments or questions before we keep going? Okay, all right, let's hone in on what the real issue is. Verse 12, so it will be that when the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, in other words, judgment begins in the house of God, he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. So what Assyria did was conform to God's will. Why they did it was not. Their sin of arrogance matched that of Judah and Israel, and they would be judged for it. But not yet. God still has work for them to do toward Jerusalem. And as we read the next two verses, I want you to pay attention, and you won't really have to because I got them all highlighted, but pay attention to how often you see the words I, my, and the phrase my hand. Look in verse 13. For he has said, by the power of my hand and by my wisdom I did this, for I have understanding, and I removed the boundaries of the peoples and plundered their treasures, and like a mighty man I brought down their inhabitants, and my hand reached to the riches of the people like a nest, and as one gathers abandoned eggs, I gathered all the earth, and there was not one that flapped its wing or opened its beak or chirped. I mean, see how many times he uses the first person pronoun? It's like listening to Barack Obama, one of his speeches, right? Remember how they used to count up how many times he would use the word I and whatnot. I mean, that's really what Assyria is doing here. The king is listing all his achievements, and ancient Assyrian annals actually collaborate this arrogance. Like most bullies, though, Assyria exaggerated their power. It's not a sin to have ability and to recognize that ability. It's a sin when we don't recognize that those abilities only come from God Almighty. Say they are gracious gifts like God had given Assyria that are to be used for a purpose, and we dare not use them to devalue others and to look at them as inferior and to boost ourselves up in our own head. Now, Isaiah compares it humorously to the falling, the way that they acted. He said, is the axe to boast itself over the one who chops with it? Is a saw to exalt itself over the one who wields it? That would be like a club wielding those who lift it, or like a rod lifting him who is not wood. I tried to look for a good picture. I'm thinking, surely somebody has drawn a silly looking picture of this thing going on, and nobody has done it yet. So anybody that's an artist in a room that wants to tackle that on, that would be hilarious. Laura Silvanero, you got it? Yep, she's smiling over there. She's doing enough for me already. But again, the axe is nothing without the forester, and the saw is nothing without the carpenter. So here's the main point that we're really starting to get from this chapter. God's sovereignty. This is a significant theme throughout the book of Isaiah. The God who is with us is the sovereign God with us. Assyria comes at God's command, but because it would not bow to the same moral law incumbent upon all of God's creation, they too would be judged. And chapter 11 is going to show us a kingdom that's going to rise in their place that's going to be even more powerful.
He's saying you're just a tool.
Yeah. You're just a tool, and you're acting like you're just the cat's pajamas, right, June? Yeah. Yeah. And since Assyria has a lack of understanding of divine to human sorrow, they're going to be in for a world of hurt. Look in verse 16. Therefore, the Lord, the God of hosts, will send a wasting disease among his stout warriors, and under his glory, a fire will be kindled like a burning flame. What do you think that occasion sounds like that we're going to get to here in a few weeks? Sounds like Isaiah 36 and 37, doesn't it? When God sent that angel overnight to kill 185,000 Assyrian troops overnight. And when this happens, Assyria's king Sennacherib should have figured out that there is a difference between idols and Jehovah. But we know from the end of chapter 37, he did not. But upon whom would this combination of fire and sickness come on? They're stout warriors. I love that because what that means is their physical prowess meant nothing to God when he's ready to judge them. Verse 17, and the light of Israel will become a fire and his Holy One a flame, and it will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in a single day. In other words, Assyria marching on Jerusalem would be like they're just jumping into a fire. There is a contrast between this verse and what we read in chapter 5 and verse 30, which describes a serious judgment against Judah. Chapter 5, verse 30 says, if one looks to the land, behold darkness and distress, even the light is darkened by its clouds. And that is true. But once a serious purpose has been fulfilled and they try to take down Zion, that darkness is going to meet a light that it was not prepared for. And Assyria is going to be like briars and thorns before them. How quickly is that going to happen according to those last four words in verse 17?
Single day.
All right, Assyria's judgment would come suddenly, almost as if it happened overnight. Wink, wink. Verse 18, and he will destroy the glory of his forest and of his fruitful garden, both soul and body, and it will be as when a sick man wastes away. So just as God destroyed Judah's vineyard for yielding worthless grapes, Assyria's vineyard would be no difference. And so notice that God is not showing any partiality whatsoever in his judgment against human sin, other than the fact he made a promise to be on Judah's side no matter how unworthy. But sin to God is sin no matter who's committing it. But for Judah, God is with us. And then look at this in verse 19. And the rest of the trees of his forest will be so small in number that a child could write them down. Notice the reference to a child. Again, a prominent theme in chapter 7 through 12. They would become so diminished in numbers. I'm imagining like a child watching all the soldiers, you know, scurrying back. And he's like, 1, 2, 3, 4. I mean, he's able to just count them all because there are just so few remaining soldiers after God takes care of them. I think that's saying something. Thoughts on that?
Ryan.
Yes, sir.
Back in the last few verses through verse 15, we read that, and you made the point that how many times I was used. Mm-hmm. You know, when we see an individual, like the one you mentioned, and others throughout history that had done that, look what I did this, and I did that, and I did something else. we sort of look at that and sort of make fun of someone for doing that. But what those individuals are doing, God had every right to speak in that way, because He's Jehovah God, the creator of everything that we know of. When man attempts to put himself in by using that same language, he's trying to put himself up as God, mm-hmm. in place of God. It never fits.
Yeah. And when we get to Isaiah 14, when he talks about Babylon, that very point is going to be made about them, about how they tried to dethrone God almost and put themselves in his seat. Yeah. Yeah, Nathan?
Along those lines, just for dinner, I warmed up some fish sticks and french fries, and my kids were like, thank you for making dinner. I said, I didn't make this. God made the food. Yeah. I just put it in an oven.
Oh man, you wasted a golden opportunity to talk about how you caught it, you filleted it, you know,
even then,
salted it, and all that.
It, you know, yeah. And so I thought that was a good, you know, a good distinction. Like, I didn't make this; God made it.
Yeah.
God made all this, and we're just kind of doing what we can.
Yeah, but are you seeing a pattern here in Isaiah that people who have a lot of success end up getting the really big head? I mean, we talked about that with Uzziah, and now we see it with Assyria, and we're going to see it with Babylon. That's just a pattern throughout history. And so maybe one thing that teaches us is the better off we do in life, the more success we have, more wealth, the more we're able to do good things, the more we need an ample amount of humility and some really good friends to surround ourselves with that'll, you know, serve us a good help and a humble pie when we need it. So,
and that gets back to the New Testament passage about it's easier, it's not as easy for a rich man. Mm-hmm. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man. And unfortunately, you hit the nail on the head. You start thinking about what I've done. Look at my house, look at my car, look. And you lose that reliance.
Yeah.
That's a powerful lesson.
Yeah, my neighbor doesn't have what I have. Guy across the pew from me, you know, he I'm a better Christian than he is. I mean, just think about all the things that kind of sometimes go in our... Now, we'll hardly ever voice it, right? But we think it so often, and shame on us. I hope we recognize it as soon as the thought gets in our minds that we can whisk it out, praying to God for humility. So,
did Israel realize that God was talking to them, saying that he was going to send Assyria after them as the ungodly nation?
I'm assuming Isaiah was very active amongst them, and Hosea and Amos alluded to it as well. So there were prophets on the scene that doing that, but I'm assuming that they did, Amanda.
Did you think during this whole description of Assyria, the children of Israel would be thinking they're terrible? Mm-hmm. Aren't you going to, you know? And but the children of Israel were being ungodly and terrible, mm-hmm. also, just like Assyria. So
yeah. And you remember Habakkuk had this problem when God said he was going to send Babylon. He was like, you're sending them against us? Yeah, sort of the same issue. Yeah. All right, let's keep going. Verse 20, the focus is going to change abruptly now from Assyria to Israel. And speaking of children, look what pops up again in verse 20. Now in that day, the remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them, but will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant within them will return, a destruction determined, overflowing with righteousness. Now, what theme pops up here that we've already seen in chapter 7 regarding a certain child? Remember the one that y'all are begging to name your kid after? Shear Jashub? Remember, a remnant shall return? That's sort of the idea right there. So since they are truly under God's protection, the destruction won't be total. It's going to be a part of God's larger purpose that they no longer lean on pagan empires for help, something that had hurt them all in the past. Israel had been at war with Syria for over 100 years before they decided to all gang up on Judah. And then Judah had been at war against Assyria, but before going to somebody else, they decide to go to Assyria and pay them off to take out Syria and Israel. Nobody relied on God. And so he judges them in order to teach them trust. That verse 21 says, mighty God is no accident. Did we study that last week? Mighty God, that's what the child would be called. Remember, wonderful counselor, mighty God. That's a reference to the same child in chapter 9, verse 6. It's almost as if God wants them to see that true power is found not in the so-called power of Assyria, that mighty Euphrates, but true power is found in those gentle waters of Shiloah that we read about in chapter 8, that of a child who would be born in this world of a virgin and whose might would be displayed through condescension and submission. And that's going to be a theme that's going to be further developed in Isaiah 49 through 55. Then in verse 22, it says, a destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness, for a complete destruction, one that is decreed, the Lord God of hosts will execute in the midst of the whole land. Now, notice how his judgment is referred to as righteous. We don't particularly enjoy the judgment aspects that we're studying. It's a little uneasy reading, and yet God's judgments are righteous. We sing it all the time, but Psalm 19 said it before we ever sang it. The judgments of the Lord are true. They are righteous altogether. It's an outworking of his holiness, his fairness. Yes, God told Abraham in Genesis 22:17 that his descendants would be as numerous as the stars in the sand, but being a physical descendant of Abraham was never to usurp the righteous conduct of Abraham, as Jesus repeatedly told the Jews. Abraham's true descendants are those who, according to Romans chapter 4, have the faith of Abraham. And to get there, there must first be judgment, which, as we just read, will be overflowing, pointing back to that Assyrian flood from chapter 8, which the Lord himself will decree. Okay, look in verse 24. Therefore, thus says the Lord God of hosts, O my people who dwell in Zion, do not fear the Assyrian who strikes you with the rod and lifts up his staff against you the way Egypt did. In other words, the discipline will hurt, but it's not going to last. God is in charge. It's comparative to Egypt's affliction upon them, which, though terrible, ended in this great redemption victory. He's calling on them to remember how that happened in order to give them hope for the future. And he then refers to them as my people. Speaking of pendulums, I actually went back and counted all this. This is actually a Ryan original here. See how illustrious it is? You see how many times the pendulum swung from being my people or your people or his people in order, like, that's good, to like how bad it was. This people, Ahaz's people, these people, the pendulum, it's just amazing to see it kind of swinging throughout these chapters. What is this about? Well, have you ever had that kid who you raised with godly principles, but then he goes off and does something just so dumb, and you're like, who are you? I don't even recognize you. And you might even be pointing to your spouse. That's your kid right there. That's not my son. You know, right? But then after a little bit of time transpires, you realize, no, that is my child. And I wonder if that's what's happening here. Verse 25, for in a very little while, my indignation against you will be spent, and my anger will be directed to their destruction. Remember the inclusio from chapters 9 and 10. His anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. His anger hasn't subsided because there's still sin to be dealt with. It's just when he's purged the filth from Zion and the remnant returns with greater faith, that anger is going to be redirected toward Assyria and their sin. How complete will Assyria's defeat be? Verse 26, the Lord of hosts will arouse a scourge against him like the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb, and his staff will be over the sea, and he will lift it up the way he did in Egypt. That slaughter of Midian refers back to Judges chapter 7. We saw another allusion to this in chapter 9, to that great battle fought between Gideon and his 300 men and the Midianites. Remember that Gideon and his 300 defeated 135,000 Midianites, and that could be an allusion to the angel striking down those 185,000 Assyrian troops overnight in Isaiah chapter 37. The rock of Oreb was actually named after the Midianite prince who escaped death from battle but was killed as he fled. This is very similar to what we see will happen to Sennacherib at the end of Isaiah 37, so stay tuned. What does the second half of verse 26 remind you of? And his staff will be over the sea, and he will lift it up the way he did in Egypt. What story?
Moses.
Yeah. Okay, Moses and the Red Sea, right? So do you see how he's giving them precedence for their rescue? God has rescued them before at the Red Sea. He's going to do it again. And then notice the contrast between that idea and in verse 24. Though Assyria brings its staff, God has his own staff. I love Hebrew poetry. It's so cool how all that stuff fits together. And then verse 27, so it will be in that day that his burden will be removed from your shoulders and his yoke from your neck, and the yoke will be broken because of fatness. Now, instead of the word fat, some of your translations might have the word oil or anointing. Hebrew poetry can be very elusive. It's difficult to know which word that should be. But if the word fat is correct, then the image that's being drawn here is of an ox who has eaten so well and worked so little, the very fat of its neck has just broken the yoke away by itself. And that's how the yoke of Assyria would be removed from them. Okay, any quick thoughts on that? We got two more slides left, but any thoughts? Yes, Amanda?
Well, since I studied Micah recently, where he goes back and tells them, well, Micah 6:3 says, oh, my people, what have I done to you, and how have I wearied you, testify against me, for I brought you up out of the land of Egypt, I redeemed you from the house of bondage. So he does the same, like, remember Egypt?
Yeah.
I helped you there.
And think about all the complaining that they did during that time. If only they had known how they were going to be a wonderful example for their descendants way on down the line because of all the things that they're experiencing. We never think about that far ahead because we're only thinking of the now. I want things to go well for me now. Well, maybe some things have to go bad for us now so later generations will learn from that. So, yeah, that's a good thought. Yeah, Micah was a contemporary, so we would expect to see some of those similar allusions. Yeah. All right, let's keep going. So if you remember back in chapter 8, Assyria was described as an overflowing flood that would sweep into Israel, cover all of its banks and channels, and it would sweep into Judah and would reach to the neck. Isaiah now describes a little bit more of how this works. In verse 28, it says, he has come against Aiath, he has passed through Migron at Michmash, he deposited his baggage. They've gone through the pass saying, Geba will be our lodging place, Ramah is terrified, and Gibeah of Saul has fled away. Cry aloud with your voice, O daughter of Galim. Pay attention, Laisha and wretched Anathoth. Madmenah has fled. The inhabitants of Gebim have sought refuge. Yet today he will halt at Nob. He shakes his fist at the mountain of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. Now, there is a pattern with these 12 cities here. They are all nations that flow from the north to the south. Now, you could get into a lot of detail about some of this, and I've got more detail than what I'm going to tell you in my notes, but for time's sake, what he's describing is the way that Assyria is going to come. They're going to get closer, they're going to get closer, they're going to get closer, and when they get to the priestly city of Nob, which is like 1 mile from Jerusalem, that's as far as you guys are going, buddy. You're not getting any closer than that. And he shakes his fist in defiance. Ah, maybe Jerusalem isn't like all those other cities that we've conquered. And that's exactly right. And in verse 33... says, behold, the Lord, the God of hosts, will lop off the boughs with a terrible crash. Those also who are tall in stature will be cut down, and those who are lofty will be abased. He will cut down the thickets of the forest with an iron axe, and Lebanon will fall by the mighty one. This is a repeat of the language from chapter 2 to show that it's not just the prideful of Judah, not just the prideful of Assyria that are going to be abased. It's going to be the pride of everybody. Judah, Israel, and now Assyria, because there is only one who is truly lofty and exalted, and that's the one that we saw in Isaiah chapter 6, the holy, holy, holy one of Israel. All right, that gets us to the end. I've got a slide explaining how Assyria eventually fell completely, but I can just leave that for the online for you guys to look at on your own if you'd like, if somebody has any comments or questions for the last couple minutes. Or if you want me to go through that real quick, we can do that too. Okay, I see a lot of heads shaking up and down. Let me tell you what happened to Assyria. How did they finally go down? Most of us are aware of the climactic fall in Isaiah 37, but that did not end the empire. That would not come until about 100 years later. During that time, Assyria found it very difficult to keep all the nations that it had conquered in check. Rebellions had broken out all over the place. It was taxing Assyria financially and militarily. And so another nation would start to rise who had already been a big thorn in Assyria's side. We know who that is, don't we? Babylon. And now the Babylonian Empire is starting to make its presence felt. In 612 BC, Babylon joined up with the Medes and conquered Assyria's capital of Nineveh. Nineveh was gone from 612 BC and on, just as the prophet Nahum had said. This was a pivotal point in history. This is where Babylon set itself apart as the pivotal empire and would be so for 73 years. And then Assyria wasn't done after this. Its capital city had fell, but 3 years later, in 609 BC, Pharaoh Necho of Egypt agreed to join forces with the Assyrian Empire, and Josiah of Judah said, nah, I think I'd prefer Babylon to be in power rather than Egypt to my south and Assyria to my north. He tried to cut off them from fighting against Babylon. Josiah lost his life because of that, and that led to the Battle of Carchemish 4 years later, in which Babylon was able to defeat Assyria and Egypt. Assyria is completely gone. Egypt runs back. Nebuchadnezzar chases him, finds out his dad had died in Babylon. He's got to turn around and go seize the throne before somebody else does. But that's how Assyria fell. There's more detail in my slides, but that's the Cliff Note version, I guess you could say. So, all right, thanks for the comments. I know we had a lot to go through, but read chapters 11 and 12 for next time on Sunday. Thanks so much.